power of attorney basically is mislabeled.
It's not really a power of attorney.
What it is a written delegation of agency authority. It's a written delegation of a principal delegating to an agent permission to act legally on their behalf. Not legally as a lawyer in a courtroom, but with respect to handling certain kinds of matters. And there's four basic kinds that we see in Michigan. Other states may have something different than this, but this is pretty much what Michigan is. The first kind is a business, general business power of attorney. This is used for somebody, perhaps, if you have an older parents or relatives that are still sharp in their mind. Okay, they can still physically take care of themselves, but it's hard for them to get to the bank. They really can't take care of their financial affairs, and they need somebody to be able to maybe sign a contract on their behalf. I'll pause for a moment and do a Jewish test. So, signing contracts at nursing homes, signing leases at apartment complexes, handling bank deposits, bank withdrawals, checking accounts, savings accounts, CDs, investments, all that kind of stuff, this person is really not very good and adept to handling and would probably screw it up and lose money or whatever the case may be. That's a general business power of attorney. I have all four of these on my computer. In fact, I've got a guy coming in this week for one of them to talk to me about one of these. Then you have what's called a durable power of attorney, which has everything that the business power of attorney has and more because it gets into medical. The durable power of attorney is going to have language in this form, and you can get these. You can get these in form books. There's legal software out there that have all these. Take care of your medical needs, but it's not like a living will where they can make a life or death decision, make a decision that this person isn't going to live anymore. It doesn't do that. That's a whole separate procedure. That's probably beyond the purview of this class. But what the durable medical power of attorney will do is allow this person to be able to communicate with the person's medical care providers, be able to have access to their medical file, and to be able to handle prescriptions, all that kind of stuff, personal needs stuff, in addition to the general business matters that I just talked about. The third type is the one time. It's for you, and you can handle all of your affairs, but you can't be in Midland, Michigan on April 4th, 2011, when the closing of your house is going to take place, because it's the last day. If any of you have been through financing houses recently, you'll know, understand what I'm talking about. And when you were approved for a rate, only if a house sale closed by a certain date, you know, if it didn't close by that date, the financing is off. There may be a new rate of interest, and you're going to start all over again with the paperwork and all that kind of thing. And you, for business reasons, cannot be in Michigan, and you don't want to lose the opportunity of getting that deal at that interest rate. And so you grant a power of attorney for one purpose only to somebody, maybe your spouse, maybe your business partner, maybe your parents, maybe your brother or sister, whoever it may be, and they can legally sign. So what a power of attorney does is, in some instances, allow somebody to legally sign for you as if it's you signing. But whenever you do, if you have that power for somebody else, you got to always make clear that you're signing under authority of a power of attorney. Always indicate that. So there's no confusion, particularly if it's a contract. There's no confusion about whether or not you're intending to enter into a contract of primary liability on something. And the last kind, for those of you that have children will be interested in this, parental authority. You can, under Michigan law, grant somebody your parental authority through a parental power of attorney that lasts for up to 6 months. It's revocable at any time. The power's in the paper. If you're going to revoke it, you've got to get the paper, and you've got to tear it up. even though we're in the electronic age. What's on a computer doesn't cut the mustard. It's got to be a written power of attorney. And it's got to have an original signature on it. And of course, it's got to be witnessed by two people. Ms. Lawson. These are used for a number of different reasons. Lindsay, we're finishing up some stuff from agency principle that I didn't cover the first time, before we're going to dive into real estate. You may have a parent that needs residential drug treatment. Otherwise, a good parent that has a drug problem and wants to go in and get the drug treatment and come on back out and be the parent again. Military. I've seen these things in the military. Where your military commitment is probably going to be longer than 6 months, but you can always renew this at the conclusion of the 6 months.
What if you're in like Iraq or Afghanistan, what at the conclusion?
To place children, hold on to that thought, because I don't want to lose the thought I just had, and then we'll get to your question. In the Detroit area, you'll see these a lot for sports reasons, where they want the kid to play sports in this other district. And so the kid has to live in that district, and so they'll do a parental power of attorney. Travel hockey players see this too. Do a parental power of attorney to place this child in a home. In fact, some of the Saginaw Spirit hockey players, I'll bet you, are subject to this, because some of them are as young as 17, so they're minors. And so you basically place the child in another home and transfer your authority as a parent to that other parent, pursuant to this written power of attorney for that period of time that you can revoke at any time you want. And so if you're in a split situation where the father and mother aren't together, you can only convey your parental authority. You can't convey the other parent's, or even affect the other parent's parental authority by issuance of this parental power of attorney. They have whatever authority they would have had. I want to get to real estate unless there's any questions about these. Well, that's right. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I got even more in-depth one. I have an aunt. She lives in Georgia. She's in the Air Force. When she's deployed to, say, Afghanistan, and she does the power of attorney.
Must be a young aunt you have.
What?
Must have a young aunt.
Yeah, my aunt's only. She was the youngest one. There's 10 of them. So.
Okay, so she's going to Afghanistan.
Say she went to Afghanistan, power of attorney, her daughter to such and such person, but like right now her father, they're divorced, was like a couple years ago trying to take her to Turkey or a Muslim country where like if once they hit the country, they wouldn't be able to get back out.
Yeah, well that's federal law that's going to be involved.
Yeah. So
we have treaties with foreign countries on enforcement of child custody orders.
So like, you know, in that case, like if she goes off to Afghanistan, does the power of parental attorney to somebody, can the father just show up at any time to take the kid?
Yes, and whoever has her authority can contest that in court.
If I have my sister gave me parental power of attorney for one of my nephews, do I also get with that the liability that goes with being a parent?
Yes.
Okay.
So you gotta be pretty careful. All right, let's get to real estate. Let's start with landlord-tenant. Because landlord-tenant combines contract law, real estate law. Let's talk about some common law stuff before we get to Michigan law. There's a term that we have from tort law. Comes back. Duties. The tenant has duties owed to the landlord, and the landlord has duties owed to the tenant. While a landlord-tenant relationship is in existence, if the parties intend a landlord-tenant relationship, landlord-tenant law applies, as long as they're carrying it out in the fashion of a landlord-tenant, which means there's some sort of consideration that's passing from the tenant to the landlord. It can be other things. I know of situations where tenants don't pay any rent at all. They basically are the handyman of the landlord. And they spend a lot of their time fixing up and cleaning up and doing maintenance and doing repairs. But that's all consideration. And that's because the landlord is obtaining receipt and benefit for that. So whether it's work or whether it's cash, it doesn't make any difference. But the duty of the tenant is to pay rent. talk about rental periods for a moment. What else, what other duties does the tenant have? Not to commit waste on the premises. I'm not talking about body waste here. Waste is a legal term in property law, in which it's caused, it's talking about basically depreciation of the property because of an act, a wrongful act of the tenant. So, chopping trees down. So,
that would be like
being so negligent in your lifestyle as to leaving water all over the place all the time, which leads to mold spores, which leads to black mold, and the next thing you know, you've got serious problems with the condition of the real estate.
Destruction of property, isn't that just like that then? Because you're destroying the
right. The tenant's duty is to possess. The tenant's obligation and right is to possess the property for a specific period of time. That's right. Unless the parties agree. Unless the landlord says, okay, you want to go chop that tree down? Fine, chop the tree down. You want to repaint the house purple and pink? Go ahead and repaint the house purple and pink. Of course, you might run into zoning problems. That's, we're going to talk about zoning later tonight. But okay. So pay rent, not to commit waste on the property, are the main two duties that the tenant has to the landlord. Duty of the landlord is to provide, and these common law duties are still good today, safe premises. What do we mean by that? I mean, the landlord can't control crime in the community. Okay, but if you're talking about a multiple unit apartment complex type situation, and the landlord knows that some of the apartments are being used basically as drug dealers, stash houses, and guys are coming in and out of there with guns all the time, and you've got children in your apartment, that would violate that tenant family's duty to be able to have safe premises. And so the landlord knows about a situation like that, and the landlord has a legal duty to eradicate that. If the police don't, the landlord has a civil obligation to do that. Not to interrupt peaceable possession by the tenant. Not a duty of the landlord. What is being sold in this landlord-tenant contract? Exclusive possession of the premises for a period of time. So then the landlord does not have the right to come in and walk in anytime they want to. Because the possession that the tenant has is exclusive. Now, there'll be a provision in the lease, and there's nothing wrong with that, to say in the event of some imminent danger to the building, fire hazard. Landlord finds out that there's no one is in the residence, but there's space heaters in it. And they've been running for 2 or 3 days. You've got an imminent fire hazard, something like that, or a gas leak in the furnace. Something along those lines, that will be... The landlord is justified in coming in even without the tenant's knowledge or possession. But primarily, the landlord can't do that. If the landlord comes in and ejects the tenant and gets what's called self-help measure without a court order, the landlord is liable to the tenant three, what we call triple damages, three times the tenant's actual damages. Actual damages are what the tenant can actually prove because suddenly they had to get a new place to stay. They had to pay a security deposit, which we'll be talking about shortly here. And first month's rent, there may be a pay for a moving van, and whatever cost they incur as a direct result of the landlord's wrongful interruption of their tenancy. There's a minimum on that is $200. So it's $200, this is Michigan statute, or three times actual damages. Or wrongful interruption by the landlord by coming in and changing the locks and throwing the tenant stuff out. The landlord can be responsible for the damage to the tenant's personal property as well. Do it. That's prime. Those are the primary duties of common law that the landlord and tenant owe to each other. Talk about rental periods. parties can enter into a lease, which is a contract, and they can provide for whatever length of rental period they want. It can be 30 days. If they want to be stupid and have a written contract for 30 days, that's very specific. It can be for a year, 6 months, 5 years, 10 years, whatever the case may be. But if there is no lease, what they have is a 30-day contract. This is really called a, if you want the legal term, a tenancy of will. Just like an employee under labor law that doesn't have a right to continue employment is called an employee of will, meaning that the employer can terminate them at any time they want. Tenancy of will means that either side can get out of this as long as there's 30 days notice. And the notice has to be the beginning of the pay period. And so you can, most people pay monthly, but some pay bi-monthly, because it's in their agreement. Some pay weekly, some pay bi-monthly, whatever it is. That's the amount of notice you must give if you're going to leave. Okay, so, there's no lease, but they agree, you're the landlord, and you agree that the tenant is going to move in May 1st, 2011. Yeah, if that tenant doesn't give the landlord notice on May 1st, 2011 that they're planning on leaving by May 31st, 2011, that landlord can collect a second month's rent, because the landlord's entitled to one whole month's notice. So notice given, let's say, on the 15th of May runs until the 15th of June. So they can give, and the landlord can agree at that point to collect half a month's rent for June if they want to, but they don't have to. So you have to give them notice, and I'm a big believer, and I've said this many times before, nothing orally under the law. Nothing. Okay? You're going to give them notice, written notice. Well, you can tell them orally, but follow it up always with something in writing. Larry?
Yeah, so those big apartment complexes that you get into, and they give you the whole contract that you sign for, say, 6 months. Now, at the end of that thing, if you don't go back in and try to renew that contract for another 6 months...
And you just stay there?
No, and you're packing up and you leave by the day that the contract ends. Now, can they hit you for another month's rent since you didn't give them notice that you don't want to renew the contract?
No, we're not talking about leases yet. We're just talking about this. I want to keep it simple to start. I'm going to get the leases. This is if there is no lease. We'll get to that. So you give 30 days notice that you're out, you have to pay for that next month, regardless of whether you stay for that next month, because the landlord was entitled to that much notice. Any questions so far? Collins?
We're just going over the contract signs, just the obligation. Like if you were living in an apartment complex or something, so, well, gee whiz, I'm still getting charged for having this such and such turned on. You can have like consumers and whatnot turned off at that place without being held in some kind of contempt of that.
You're talking about after the lease is you're talking about a lease that's expired?
Like you have a 30-day thing, right?
And you stay. You don't leave.
You didn't give them 30 days because you left, but you didn't give them the proper notice.
You didn't give them the proper notice.
And you still have to pay for that month.
You have to pay for that month, but it's your obligation to get your name, the utilities shut off, get your name off those utilities.
Okay, you can.
And you won't be able to do that if you hold balance.
Okay.
If your rental agreement was that you pay the utilities instead of the landlord, it's a landlord's responsibility. You don't have to worry about it.
But no, if I'm
paying it's yours, you got to get it turned off of your name.
Just off the name.
Yes, which is fine as long as the balance is paid up.
Okay.
Other than that, because they know they can get the landlord on it, because they will get what's called a lien in the premises for any unpaid utilities, a lien right in the real estate, which is a security.
But you can't charge
ultimately convert to cash flow.
But you can't have them shut it off for that place that you're staying in.
You have to shut it off. You talking about the tenant shutting it off?
Yes.
How can a tenant? No. Tenant can't shut anything off. All the tenant can do is give them notice and say, I'm leaving here. I want this off my name.
Okay.
If it was your responsibility to pay the utilities, then you have to do that through that period of time.
Okay,
well, what happens if he gave notice, but he didn't leave? He just stayed there. Then he still has to pay for that rent for that month. What's more interesting, I'll start talking about leases now, is if the lease expires. But nothing happens. The landlord doesn't do anything. The tenant stays, and the tenant pays rent. Guess what? If that was 1 year lease, under the doctrine of holding over, this is a landlord doctrine, guaranteed. Under the doctrine of holding over, the party just renewed that for another year. Because that tenant wasn't out of there. And that tenant tendered another check, and that landlord didn't take any steps to get them out of there or to find a new tenant to come in and rent the premises. So beware that if you've got a lease that's expiring and you don't particularly want to leave yet, but you don't want to be obligated for another year, you got to make sure that you get an agreement, a new agreement, to cover how long you do want to stay. You don't just do nothing. So a lease is a contract between the parties. What's a lease going to provide? The term of the contract, usually but not always a year. Information on the security deposit. Inventory checklist. Are any landlords in here? I know we have tenants in there. Come on. A few miscellaneous provisions required by Michigan statute that have to be in bold type. Nothing real significant, I don't think. We're spending time on a little time that we have here. And the rules and regs on what the tenant can and can't do. The contract may say what the notice has got to be. Parties are free to enter into an agreement to change what the common law rules if they want to. Now we got chalk all over. When you're a black shirt. Security deposit. This is to prevent the tenant from stiffing the landlord, running out rent, and then suddenly leaving. The landlord's left holding the bag. Security deposit can be up to 1.5 months rent. Now again, we're not in common law anymore. This is Michigan statute. That's the most you can charge. Security deposit is supposed to be for unpaid rent. But it can ultimately turn out to be other things as well, which we'll get to. A security deposit is the tenant's property, not the landlord's property. That's why we call it a security deposit that the landlord can hold. The landlord must have this deposited in a regulated financial institution. The inventory checklist is in the lease. The inventory checklist means, and you have something similar with the sale of property called the seller's disclosure statement. And this protects the tenant. And if you're a landlord and you don't have this in the lease, guess what? You're stuck with all the damages. Inventory checklist means that at the beginning of the tenancy, the landlord or the tenant is supposed to go around to all of the aspects of the residence and agree if there's any pre-existing damage. And then check a box on the form. These standard forms that you can use. The idea being is, if both parties agreed at the beginning of the tenancy that, let's say, the downstairs bathroom had no damage whatsoever, and both sides also agree at the end of the tenancy that there are these large holes in the wall of the downstairs bathroom, then it's easy to determine who's responsible for that damage, and that, of course, would be the tenant. Unless the tenant can prove that the landlord came in one night and had a temper tantrum in the bathroom and punched the holes in the wall. Probably can't prove that. If no inventory checklist is included in the lease at the beginning of the premises, then the landlord's stuck with the damages, all the damages. What do we mean by damages? Not really the same as in the contract sense. Everything, let me put it this way, everything except ordinary wear and tear and cleaning costs. Cleaning cost is pretty easy to figure out. Now, landlords can insert that in the lease, and if the tenant agrees to it, the tenant could be responsible for the cleaning cost. But if there's nothing mentioned in the lease, the tenant is not responsible for cleaning costs. What's ordinary wear and tear and what's damage? Here's your common sense. Carpets obviously wear down, paint fades, place gradually gets to the point where it needs a lot of refurbishing. That's ordinary wear and tear. Holes in the carpet from cigarettes and terrible stains in the carpet because of animal feces and on it goes. Holes in the wall, not ordinary wear and tear. Huge chunks of carpet missing, not ordinary wear and tear. Rules and regulations of the lease. Can you have pets or not? Some of these places try to keep them to be family friendly. And so you can't have somebody staying overnight that's not a member of your family more than one night in a row or on a goes. You can't have anybody, any other adult living there other than the adults that sign the lease. They don't want to turn into a party house. Okay. Or even worse than that.
If you do have pets, they have to be a certain size or weight.
What's that?
If you do have pets, you have to have...
Yeah, they have all these different weights.
Type like that?
If you don't have a lease, then none of that stuff applies. Let's talk about the size of the leases and subleasing. Contract rules that we study pretty much apply. If the landlord and the tenant both agree, the tenant is going to leave and a new tenant is going to be substituted in to be responsible and live there. And that's, like we said in contract law, that's a novation, and that lets the original, that gets the original tenant off the hook and they're not responsible for the balance of the rent, the new tenant is. But if the landlord didn't agree to that, and the tenant attempts a substitution, or the tenant intends to have a sublease, so that the tenant actually becomes the landlord, and now we have a new tenant, a sublease. Or perhaps a new co-tenant comes in, and the original tenant says, well, I'm not responsible for all the rent now, I'm only responsible for half of the rent, because there's a co-tenant now. Now that the landlord didn't agree to that, you're the original tenant, you're responsible for all of the rent. Now you may be able to bring an action against your co-tenant for contribution to the rent. But you still are responsible if you sign the original lease for all of the rent.
Oh, yeah, I have another question for you about the co-tenants. I heard like random stories from more than one person that they have somebody like say, oh yeah, hey, can I crash on your couch while I look for a new place for like 3-4 days? And what's the time limit before that person becomes like a resident of that place and you can't kick them out?
Common law, there is no such thing.
If I heard people taking,
there's a lease, the language of the lease will determine it.
Because I heard people saying that they took people to court over and they lost, saying that that person was attended and they don't have to pay rent if you didn't establish that through the first 3 days. Or
you can get into a constitutional issue, actually, if the regulations get to be so intrusive into the person's privacy and their personal life. There is a part of the Fifth Amendment deals with the right to peaceably use and enjoy property. And as long as you're the tenant, you have the sole right to possess that property for that part of point in time. So there have been some lawsuits, some of these things that have gone to court. Usually it's in favor of the landlord, but there have been a few decisions that say they went a little bit too far. Say, well, you can't have two members or two gay people living there or whatever it is. It just gets to the point where it's just too intrusive into the person's right to peaceably use and enjoy the property in the manner that they see fit. So there is a line there that they can cross.
No, what I was trying to ask was that, like, I heard stories of, like, say, a girl signs a lease for an apartment. And later on, her boyfriend moves in, and they only live together for like 3 weeks, and then the girlfriend breaks up the boyfriend, kicks the boyfriend out. And I heard more than one story of the boyfriend being able to break back into the apartment because...
So it's always a bad idea, lady. I can tell you, from practicing law for 29 years and doing a lot of divorce law...
Or the same thing for the guys.
Don't do it, unless it's somebody you're going to get very serious with. You're going to regret it, and you're going to pay a price for it.
But I heard more than one horror story.
You're going to end up losing your property, or you're going to end up losing money. Not unless it's somebody that's a keeper and that you're very serious with. You are going to lose. Michigan does not... That brings up another point, Lucas said. I'll get back to you. Cohabitation relationships. And oh, I'm conservative in an old fashioned very well. But I know from experience in practicing law. Michigan doesn't recognize this relationship. Meaning that, remember that implied in law contract doctrine we talked about way back when? If it's just a regular tenant, yes, you can bring them into court for an implied in law contract. We haven't applied it, you moved in here. We haven't applied in law contract for you to pay half the utilities. We haven't applied in law contract for you to pay half of the rent. And you haven't been doing it. And so, but if the relationship is sexual in nature, you'll get nowhere. The court does not recognize that relationship. They don't want to hear about it. You'll be thrown out of court, basically. And also, what happens is, people are living together, and then suddenly they're not, and they say, well, he's got my property. He won't give it back. Forget it. What you're talking about is what's called a claim and delivery lawsuit in district court, which can be up to how much money in damages? As we start to get ready, sort of, for the final exam, $25,000, right? District court's up to $25,000. And then the other party, if it's in this relationship, says, no, that was mine. That was my stuff. I'm the one who bought it. And now each one's scrambling to find a receipt that they bought it. The receipt doesn't have a name on it. It's just a receipt. You ain't getting nowhere. Don't do it. Especially if it's something, it's a house or something that you worked hard for, that you have. I know the guys don't let you talk anymore. It goes the other way around, too. You know, you can guarantee it can be guys getting taken advantage of by women as well. Protect what you have accumulated, what you've worked hard for, what you have. No joint bank accounts. I even say that to married people when they get married. No joint bank accounts, no prenuptial agreements, none of that. I can tell you, a prenuptial agreement is a guaranteed divorce. Because you plant that seed at the beginning of the marriage. Yeah, this is what's going to happen if they get a divorce, huh? Have they given me full disclosure? Has he told me everything? Plant that seed. And then something else happens later on? Yeah, I knew that. I knew that that guy was up there. Distrust is there. And that seed of distrust grows to guarantee divorce. Don't do it. The same thing with the cohabitation. If neither one of you has a pot to you-know-what in, you know, you're both extremely poor, then maybe do it. Collins?
No, I didn't. Like for Johnny Carson or somebody, you know, he has all that money, and then his wife joins a relationship and doesn't have any money. And then the next day you see Johnny Carson, like, all his money gone.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to, okay. interesting stuff, but we don't want to get too far.
No, I'm saying, what is that? Me, is there a reason to have a prenuptial agreement?
No. First of all, the judge doesn't have to enforce the prenuptial agreement.
Oh.
Did you know that? The judge has to make a determination that it's fair, just like he does a liquidated damages provision in a contract.
Wow.
Same thing. Is it fair, number one? Number two, was there full disclosure? Is there something he didn't disclose? If there was something he didn't disclose, he's not going to enforce it. So I'm not going to draw up something that I'm not 100% sure that people are going to rely upon, that I'm not 100% sure a judge is going to enforce.
Wow.
And I know there's lawyers out there, there's lawyers out there that will do anything you ask them to. That doesn't mean that's a lawyer you should hire. We gotta get back, and I gotta get off my soapbox. All right. Okay, so let's talk more about the security deposit and what happens when somebody leaves and tenant moves out and gets notice and all that sort of thing. Four days. Tenant has to provide the landlord with a forwarding address within 4 days. We let the landlord off the hook for coming back. Days is the period of time the landlord has to send the tenant back an itemized statement of whether he's going to use any of the security deposits to pay for damages or unpaid rent. And the rest of it has to be returned. Or if that isn't the end of the story, then the landlord has an additional 15 days for a total of 45 days. The landlord is required to file suit in district court. Because again, it's the tenant's property. So the landlord would be, it's be conversion for the landlord just to take it. So the landlord's got to sue the tenant in district court to get an order from the district judge saying, okay, you provide the proper notice, you show me for some security deposit, that these were not pre-existing damages, you're entitled to this. And of course, 1.5 months rent, which is the most it can be the security deposit, may very well not cover it. So in this lawsuit that the landlord filed against the tenant, the landlord can sue for the balance of the damages too.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just going to reiterate what you just said. If I move somebody out of an apartment and they've damaged that apartment and I determine that it's going to cost me $250 to fix it, I can't just take that $250, I have to go...
No, you have to follow this procedure. Now, you weren't here, you came late tonight, when we were talking about security, the inventory checklist. You're familiar with the inventory checklist?
I'm a landlord.
Okay, so you know about the inventory checklist. So to protect yourself, you got to make sure that you've done that. And if pursuant to the inventory checklist, it's not pre-existing damage, and you're going to be able to collect for it. But you got to follow this procedure. So they let you off the hook by not giving you their address within 4 days, and then you're good. Then you're good to do what you want. Okay. But they gave you that forwarding address at the time they left her within 4 days. You don't have to wait 30 days. That's the most time you have. You can send them that itemized list. You don't have to wait 45 either. Send them that itemized list and file that lawsuit as fast as you want. But you got to do it within these 30 or 45 day parameters.
If I'm going to keep that money, then can I also keep the filing fees? And
you have to ask the judge to award you that as part of your incidental damages in your lawsuit. Okay. Let's talk about eviction. Two tags, 7 and 30 day. These are notices, written notices the landlord has to give the tenant. 7 day notice you can do for not paying the rent or serious health hazard. 1 day late on the rent, unless your lease says you've got a window period, grace period. So not payment of rent or serious health hazard, which includes he's turned it into a crack house. That's a serious health hazard too, or a meth lab, or something even worse than that. House of prostitution, that would probably apply as well. Okay, Because once you get into things like that, the landlord's concerned about, oh my God, there's forfeiture laws that apply. And if I don't take action, the police may forfeit this house because it was used as a house of prostitution or a drug house. There's standard forms. You're going to be a landlord. Get the forms. Send a day notice. Take it right over there. If you're not home, leave it at the door. Other reasons for the eviction, even if it's just, I don't want to renew, maybe you didn't have a lease, so it's 30-day notice. Or some other violation of the lease. He's got pets in there, he's not supposed to have pets in there. Whatever the violation is. They don't leave, you go to court, standard pre-printed written form, you can get them online, get them in office supply stores and books. Sometimes they can hand them out at the courthouses. Easy, some of the blank forms. You're really, especially if you have one of my classes, it sounds like I'm being cocky here, you shouldn't have to hire a lawyer to do this. Any one of you ever going to be in this predicament, if you're my students, I give you carte blanche to call me for help. If you've been my student once, you're my friend. Okay? So I'll help you with it. But you shouldn't have to shell out bucks, hard-earned money for a lawyer for this. They're easy, fill in the blank forms. You get in front of the judge and say, I'm moving to have this person evicted for not paying the rent, for serious health hazard, for violation of the lease, and I wish this person to be out as soon as possible. You get in front of the judge, and it's up to the judge to decide how much time to give them. The judge has some discretion. And sometimes the judge feels sorry for people, and they may give them a little extra time to get out. Then you get a judgment. We talked about judgments already. Just like any other civil judgment. Judgment means that as of the date the judge has ordered that person out, you have a right as the landlord to come in and occupy the premises, which includes changing the locks and whatever else you have to do. But what if they don't leave? And you got to go back to district court 5 days after the judgment and get what's called a writ of restitution. I don't know why it's called this. Restitution means payment of money for losses, but that's not what this is. A writ of restitution is the judge signs an order ordering the sheriff's department a bodily removal. One of the first things I ever did in the practice of law was a firm down in Roseville before I moved up here. And I went out for a family and watched a writ of restitution being served. The sheriff's department bashed in the door. Okay, well, you got insurance maybe there. Maybe deductible though. And they went in there and they bodily dragged this guy out of there. He wasn't coming. And that's what the writ of restitution is. Someone's got to get him out of there somehow. And the sheriff's department will go in and bodily drag him out. And of course, that's a very good way. You haven't had me for evidence of procedure. That's a very good way to be charged with a felony of resisting obstructing an officer in the lawful performance of their duty. That's probably what they'll do. This person doesn't come out willingly. I want to get into Chapter 49 now.
But once you have a judgment, once you have a judgment against them, can you toss their stuff out to the curb?
When it gets to be that date, the judgment will have a date.
And as of that date,
where you have legal possession of it now.
So I can go in and throw their stuff out.
Throw that curb.
Okay.
But you can't destroy it.
You can't destroy it.
What happens if I take it out?
The weather might destroy it, but you can't.
I emptied out a guy's house who moved out and left his whole house full. And I took all of his crap out to the curb. And within 2 hours, it was all gone. Because people came and picked it up. So, do I... If
you put it out on the curb in Midland, somebody else is going to come by and pick it up.
Right. Do I have any liability for that?
Nope.
Okay.
That's handled in the court case. The judge will decide that. Usually what you'll do, the judge will say when you can do it. I would ask just to be careful about it, just to be sure. Have that provision included in the judgment that you're entitled to do. Okay, Chapter 49, real property. Land, easements. Before we get to easements, the first thing we're going to do is talk about several different types of legal interests in land. First is fee simple. These are old common law terms. That means you own it. You own it outright. You own every aspect of it. Or you can be a joint owner. two ways to be a joint owner. One, as a tenant in common. And two, as a joint tenant with rights of survivorship. Technically, there's a third one called tenants by the entirety, but it's the same interest as this one. So we'll talk about the second one first. In a joint tenancy with rights of survivorship, you and somebody else, maybe more than one other person, each own all of the property simultaneously, and you can't sever it unless both of you sign off the property. Because unless both agree, you're conjoined to continue to own this property jointly. They refer to it in common law as the unity of time, title, and interest in the property. And so it's a collective ownership, and you only can change it by everybody signing. And sometimes it can be 5, 6, 7 people. It's really great. You never want to get involved in a family situation with 3 or 4 or 5 other people in one of these kinds of interests, because you're all locked in unless everybody agrees. And usually when you have a large group like that, there's always one stick in the mud. There's always one that maybe doesn't quite get along with the others. Particularly, I can say that being Irish, 100% Irish, Irish families are notorious for people not getting along. I get along with everybody in the whole world, but I have a brother I don't get along with. And there's a couple of judges I actually don't get along with. A couple of judges, a couple of prosecutors, and my one brother. Boy, Irish families are. They did. Polish families are different. Polish families are tight. Irish families are not. That's just the way it is. No. You get locked in, you're stuck. The tenants by the entirety is what you call it when a husband and wife own real estate. So if the real estate deed conveyed it to John and Ann as tenants by the entirety, it created this legal interest in this issue. Locked in, joined together, and only both could sign the change. So I guess we'll say, or tenants by entirety, married. And maybe you want it this way because if it's this way, you avoid probate court. Because when one dies, it goes to the survivor. That's why we have the word survivorship. If there's 3 of you, once 2 die, and then 1 survivor that's left, now they own it as fee simple. Tenancy in common is the other way to have a joint interest in property with somebody else. And in tenancy in common, if it's 2 people, we'll keep it simple here. You have a severable 50% interest in the property with somebody else. In tenants in common, you can sell your 1/2 interest to somebody else. If you die, your 1/2 interest goes to your estate, to whoever it goes to. If you have no will, it goes under Michigan's intestate law, please no jokes. If you have a will, it passes under the terms of the will, whoever you elect it to. In Michigan's intestate law, if a husband died and he didn't have a will, the first $100,000 goes to his wife, and he starts splitting with his children after that. If he has no wife, it goes to all of his children. If he has no children, it goes to his parents. If he has no parents, it goes to his collaterals, which are his brothers and sisters. That's Michigan's intestate. Otherwise, it goes in accordance with the will. With joint tenants by survivorship, never sees court. It's by operation of law. We may have a new owner, which is the survivor of the one who died. Now they own it as descendants. Now, I've seen a lot of real estate documents through the years, and there's a lot of sloppy draftsmanship. And you gotta be really careful. I've seen deeds that said joint tenants as tenants in common. And I've seen tenants in common with survivorship creates ambiguities. And now everybody has to end up in court trying to figure out what was the intent of the grantor when they executed the deed in the first place. Which type of legal relationship were they intending to create with the document? So you gotta be careful. And even recently I've seen, I scratched my head, how the hell could any lawyer have drafted it? Okay, we have other types of answers, questions about this. And of course, that interest is passed by a document called a deed. What do you have to have on a deed? Let's talk about a deed for a moment. And then we'll get back to other types of interest in property. Which interest you're creating, as we just talked about. The marital status of the parties has to be on there. And you have to have the legal description, which is always on the deed. The meets and the bounds in the northwest quarter or the southwest quarter of the... If you own property, go home and look at your deed. You'll see what I'm talking about. Witnesses and a notary. Now, why marital status? That's because of common law, the wife had dower rights. A wife is guaranteed one-third interest in all real estate acquired during the course of marriage by the husband. Not pre-existing real estate that the husband had prior to the marriage, but real estate the husband created or acquired during the marriage. It doesn't make any difference how he acquired it. It doesn't make any difference if he inherited it. It doesn't make any difference if it was given to him. It doesn't make any difference if he paid $100 million for it out of his pre-marital money. None of that makes any difference. If it's real estate acquired during the marriage, the wife is guaranteed not half, interestingly, but one-third interest in that property. And that's a lien that's in that property. And if you can't tell whether or not a wife released her dower on the property, that's a defect on the property, and no title insurance will issue a policy so that the sale can close until that issue is cleared up. That's why the marital status. Because what we don't want to have is husbands trying to sneak their real estate out of marital ownership so they don't have to account for it before divorce. They say, hey, I'm going to convey this to you now. I'm not going to put my marital status on the deed. I may get through this divorce, and then you can acquire it, and then you can give it back to me, okay? Pretty much takes care of that. And so the Register of Deeds office should not accept any deed that doesn't have the marital status of the parties on there, the grantor and the grantee. And chocolate here. Keep going here.
There's blue on the other.
What? Okay, should we stop
then?
Oh, the blue. Blue and green
look right
here.
Agreed.
Let's see this a little bit. Want to hear this?
I know. I hope trying some more.
Get some more interest. Can you see this? Bad or good?
Barely. I can see it. Life.
I wouldn't use it.
Date. She just went for you to get more chalk for you.
Family member probably wouldn't be able to have a place to live if you didn't provide it for them. But you want it back. You'd like them to have it for the rest of their life. Well, you don't want them to be able to sell it or to will it to somebody else. You want it back. And so with a life estate, you can say, I hereby convey my farm in Greendale Township to my grandmother, Mary Jones, for the rest of her natural life. That's a life estate that comes back to you legally, the interest does, at the time that she dies. Or, be simple with a reverter, and this is less common than a life estate, farm families. They don't want a Walmart. It's been farm families for 300 years, they want to continue to be a farm. Always be a farm. I hereby convey my farm to my son Louis, but only so long as my property is used as a farm full time. he operates this full-time as a family farm. In the event that my son Louis ceases to operate my farm full-time as a family farm, and in fact operates it for some different purpose, then this property reverts back to me.
How is that possible if he's dead?
What's that?
What if he's dead? That
it reverts back to his heirs, and then an estate has to be opened up. And you have to go down to the probate court and open up an estate so somebody has the legal right to be able to deal with it. And it's probably going to be sold at that point. This used to be done for racial discrimination purposes. I hereby leave my home to my son George. Oh, thank you very much. Let's say it's rental property. It's always been rental property. I hereby leave my rental property to my son George, but only so long as he does not lease to members of the African American race. This was common. It's more common in the South than it was anywhere else. Our courts will not enforce racially segregated, these are called racial covenants. You can't do something like this to discriminate against people based upon their religion or background, because the court will not enforce that if somebody comes into court and challenges its enforcement. No more blue. All right, let's get some more interest up there. Easement. An easement is a right-of-way. To adverse possession next. Easement is a right-of-way across somebody else's parcel. So this is your parcel. These issues, you have these more out in the rural area than anywhere else. So let's say this is like way back in there. There's not really a road in there. Lawrence?
Actually, Meridian High School has some of these. There's a parcel of land behind Meridian High School.
Yeah.
If you drive back through there, there's a road heading back towards the lake. That's actually, you get so far back, and it turns right on the line of the Meridian High School property. There's private science properties because it turns into private property.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Yeah. Let's call this, since you brought it up, Meridian Road, M30. Okay. This is parcel A, this is parcel B. Okay, this is Lucas's property, this is Lawrence's property. Lucas wants to be able to get to Meridian Road. Now there's a little sort of trail that cars can use and ATVs use. It's no big deal. It's a trail. It's usable. That's not a paved road or anything. Right? Say Lucas's house is sort of here. In order for Lucas to get to Meridian Road, he's got to go here, and then there, and cut there, and then over there, back over there, and eventually he gets to Meridian Road. He could just take this little trail across Lawrence's property. He gets to Meridian Road a whole lot easier. So this is a card that Lawrence holds. These two guys can negotiate. They can work any deal out. Lawrence can be a nice guy and say, yes, you can use it. Or Lawrence can say, I'll sell it to you. But once he does that, Lucas has the right to use it forever. Okay. Once an easement is granted, and it's granted in a written document, just like a deed, filed at the Register of Deeds office, just like a deed. Oh, by the way, speaking of the Register of Deeds office, again, to make sure everybody, I think we mentioned this once before, to make sure everybody understands. Title does not pass on real estate when you file a deed with the Register of Deeds. Title passes to real estate when the deed is physically delivered to the grantee. Filing with the Register of Deeds is just a notice. It's a smart thing to do. To let the whole world know who now owns this property. But filing with the Register of Deeds is not what creates you as being the owner of that property. Lawrence?
Another question about this. My cousin, he went to law school, then he decided not to be a lawyer for some reason.
Take a break at 7:40.
After he graduated. But he actually bought property from his mother, and took a loan out against the bank and everything, so he's paying it off to the bank. But he actually put it back, he bought the property off the road, so his mom still owns those lands surrounding the property, and he used the easement thing, and I guess when he wrote up the contract for the easement, because he wrote it up himself, he said, as far as his natural owning of the property, the easement, and blah, blah, blah. So is that possible that if he loses the property and his house goes up for foreclosure, that
once
that
the easement's been created, it goes with the property, stays with the property, just like a fixture. Fixture is something that is built on the property, loses its character as personal property, and becomes part of the real estate. Same thing with an easement.
So you can't
same kinds of easements.
So you can't write up an easement saying it's naturally as blah 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 owns the property. After
your question is really, can you draw up an easement to say this only applies for a certain length of time?
No, for a certain length of time, or for a person that owns the property.
No, oh, it goes with the property.
All right.
Yeah.
Can you do one for a certain length of time?
Yes. You got three kinds: express, public, and proscriptive. Pre-prescriptive or proscriptive? It's prescriptive, that's right.
I almost spelled the word wrong.
Not me. Not the fourth grade spelling champion in math and Harvard. I don't just spell words. I do a lot of other bad things. Express easement, written document, notarized, witness, filed in the register of deeds, just like a deed. Okay, that way anybody can check the public filing and see who it is that has an interest in this property, who it is that has an easement across this property. So an easement is a right of way. Public easement. Cable companies, utility companies have this by law. Cables, lines, whatever they got to do to be able to operate public utility or cable, fiber optic, all that good stuff. Anybody here working anything else? You do.
No, question.
Question.
So for the public thing, they said, Consumer Fire said, you know what, we have to put a post right here in your backyard.
They have an easement to come
out. We can do this right now. We can put one of these towers right up in your backyard.
Yep.
Wow.
Prescriptive.
You bought the property.
Again, I want to move along here. I'm trying to get a lot of cover, but I'll stay till 10 o'clock tonight answering questions if anybody wants to do that. Oh, and by the way, as far as going over the test, again, I don't want to, not tonight. We'll have time to do that. I'll stay after tonight to do that, or we can do that on a review for the final exam. I want to get all this real estate stuff tonight. Prescriptive. 15 years, that's the big period, which also applies for adverse possession, as we'll see. You've been using, you don't have an express easement, no one told you you could use it. Back to Lucas and Lawrence here. Lucas started using this little trail to get to Meridian Road, and Lawrence never gave him permission. And he can show that he did it for 15 continuous years. He now can do it forever. Because 15 years gives you lifetime use. Prescriptive easement. Once you have an easement, now we get back into this legal duty stuff again. Once Lucas's easement is established, now Lawrence has a duty to maintain the easement so that Lucas can use it safely. No. So he has to make sure that Lucas can continue to operate his vehicle across that trail, or if he's walking across it, or if he's cross-country skiing across it, whatever he's doing.
So you can't put it in the easement as a subtitle or something in there saying if you want to use this easement, you have to do all the maintenance and blah, blah, blah to it?
That is a contract, which requires what? A mutual exchange of consideration.
Right,
yes, so parties can do a contract, a mutual exchange of consideration to do just that.
So you can make a contract.
You can do that with anything.
With the easement, basically.
Yeah. Okay, so now here's the other important thing to remember. When you're buying real estate, thinking that, well, a seller's obligation to provide title insurance. That's right. Seller has the obligation to provide title insurance because Michigan law requires the seller must be able to show if property is being sold 45 continuous years of what's called marketable title. I know I'm throwing a lot at you here, but bear with me and it'll all fit. So the seller's responsibility to be able to show 45 years of uninterrupted, no defects in the title. Nobody has a claim on the property, nobody has a lien on the property. There's not some dollar rights dangling out there that have never been released. Clear chain for 45 years. Seller's responsibility to provide marketable title.
I can't remember why I got that. I even got into this. Can you believe that? I just drew a blank.
How often does that happen?
That means I don't
do that one.
I'm sorry, I got it.
But title insurance doesn't say anything at all about who might have an easement, a prescriptive easement. You got to do two things if you're going to buy property to find out whether or not somebody has a prescriptive easement for 15 years. You got to go out there and physically inspect the premises. You can tell. My brother bought a bunch of property to build a house back in 1997, and he didn't get the house built until 2000. I went out there and inspected it. I could see that there was a school. There's some woods leading right up to the end of a school, a yard in the back of a school. I could see this trail. He lived at the end of a cul-de-sac. I can see the students were coming up the cul-de-sac. They were walking across these woods in this trail up to the back of the school. I said, you better find out if this has been done for 15 years because you won't be able to build in any of this area. You better look at this. He did. As it turned out, he didn't mind kids using that, and he made sure they can still use it. He didn't even care whether it was 15 years. But I told him that. So there's two things you got to do. Physically inspect the area to see if something looks like somebody's using it as a trail or right away. Talk to the neighbors. You've got to talk to the neighbors. Hey, neighbors, can you tell me how long people have been using this trail? To see if you got your 15 years. Okay? Title insurance only goes by what's at the register of deeds, what's in the record of title. They don't guarantee any facts or legal interests that have been determined outside the chain of title, which is what we're talking about.
State land. How does that work with all the trails going through people's properties to the roads and stuff? Like, I got a buddy that has a truck, basically where you can drive a truck through his property to state land.
How long? That's what you got to find out.
So if he's
and the party that is claiming they have the easement, then they have the burden of proof. What we're talking about here is an equitable lawsuit in circuit court. If somebody wants to go in and get an adjudication of the legal interest, that's an equitable action. They're the ones that have the burden of proving it. If they got the 15 years. You don't have the burden of proving they don't have the 15 years. One last point, and we'll take the break. You can get this 15 years two different ways. Under the principle of law known as tacking. It's not very tacky, but that's just, it's tacking. Let's say you can show 10 years, but the people you bought it from used it the same way for 5. You can take their 5, tack it on to your 10 to get your 15. Great time. Lindsay, I'm glad you're here tonight. I need to chat with you. You look tired tonight. You didn't sleep, huh?